Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a series all about radio broadcast on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate radio, radio ownership and radio's history and future prospects. Coming up on the July edition of Wireless, we report from the Summer School on Transnational Radio History held recently at the University of Luxembourg, and we reminisce about that tiny country's greatest ever radio export. The Broadcasting Authority of Ireland launches a new archiving scheme which aims to preserve valuable audiovisual heritage, including radio. We hear what's going on at another student radio station, Queen's Radio in Belfast, and we look back at the National Community Radio Day held last month.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
But first to Radio Retro, which each month delves into the archives to unearth a gem from radio history. As we're reporting from Luxembourg this month, it made sense to reminisce about the tiny Grand Duchy's greatest ever radio export, Radio Luxembourg, which entertained listeners throughout Western Europe from 1933 until its eventual demise in 1992. Luxembourg was Europe's largest commercial station and used one of the most powerful AM transmitters in the world, exerting a huge influence on generations of radio listeners who were fed up with the staid offerings of their public state broadcasters. Radio Luxembourg has been credited with making pop and rock music popular, and its English service gained an enormous audience in Britain, Ireland and other Western European countries. Broadcasting on longwave originally, in later years it was best known for its programmes on 208 metres medium wave, or 1440 kilohertz. Here's a snippet from one of the many tribute sites.
208. It's great. In January 1933, a keen radio fan searching along the radio dial picked up a new station, Radio Luxembourg, on the air with experimental broadcasts. Weeks later, the station was ready to begin commercial broadcasting, and airtime was soon available in the French, German, and Luxembourgish languages. Soon, programs in English could be heard from the new station.
Hi, this is Bob Stewart. These were tremendously important days for commercial radio. A whole new way of life was emerging for radio listeners in the United Kingdom. Radio Luxembourg was broadcasting all day Sundays with easy listening music programs.
In September 1939, the Luxembourg government took over the station, and for a period of about 2 weeks, they broadcast special news bulletins. But before the end of September, Radio Luxembourg was silent.
Your request records will always play. If you drop a note to us and do it right away, give the tune on the label and your favorite star. Tune in to 208, my friends, and there you are.
A brief flavour of Radio Luxembourg, courtesy of 208, it was great, radioluxembourg.co.uk. And we'll have another Radio Retro feature in September.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
A summer school on transnational radio history was held at the University of Luxembourg last month. Organised by the Luxembourg Centre for Contemporary and Digital History, it was a fantastic week of research presentations, discussions and visits to transmitter sites, including that of Radio Luxembourg. Finding people who are as passionate about radio as I am is rare enough, so I was really delighted to hear others saying that they no longer felt like weirdos to be getting excited about transmitters and studio facilities. As part of the summer school, participants produced short podcasts about what the week meant to them. Here's an example of one such podcast, and you'll hear that the very international and multilingual group roped me in to provide a sentence in Irish.
Bienvenidos a la Universidad de Luxemburgo. Este es el podcast de historia transnacional de la radio.
University of Luxembourg se hum kar rahe hai transnational nabhavani ka itihas ke bare mein podcast.
Welcome to the University of Luxembourg. This is the Transnational Radio History Podcast.
Fáilte go dtí oscail Luxembourg, seo an pod chraoile faoi stair an radio transnáisiúnta.
Bienvenidos a la Universidad de Luxemburgo al podcast de historia transnacional de la radio.
My name is Eddie Bohan. I'm from Dublin in Ireland. I'm a broadcast historian and I'm here in Luxembourg at the Transnational Radio School to see how other professionals in the field are archiving radio and how transnational radio has been underreported, underarchived. And I have brought some of my own material from Ireland, looking at transnational radio, especially one of the most famous stations in Ireland was Atlantic 252, which broadcast from 1989 until early 2000. It was a cooperation between RTL, Radio Télé Luxembourg, which is apt since we are in Luxembourg, and the Irish state broadcaster Radio Télévision. It was a pop channel aimed basically at the British market. I came to tell that story and the story of Irish radio from a transnational point of view, and I've learned so much more. I've learned so much more about transnational radio across Europe, across the world, and I've met some really wonderful, interesting and very pleasant people.
I'm Gloria Khamkar and I'm a lecturer in journalism at Bournemouth University, UK, and I'm here to participate in this transnational radio history summer school at University of Luxembourg. My main intention of coming here is to share my own research, which is on the British Asian radio in England, and I'm also here to learn more about transnational radio history. And I have been listening to very fascinating papers on, you know, various topics from late night radio to radio transmitter architecture. And having delegates from all over the world and having different points of views, experience, research, knowledge, it has just made me, you know, feel so good and happy about what is being done in the area of transnational radio history and what can be done more.
My name is Francisco Garrido. I'm from Chile. I'm here to learn more about transnational radio history and also to present about the history of manufacturing radio companies in Chile and how their production was embedded with ideals of progress and future for the nation, especially during the early 20th century. And also to see how their devices, their physical radios, also basically in their aesthetics, in their social practices we use, also reflected certain processes of transformation and change of the society during that time. So I'm interested in the material culture of radios and the history of their production, and see how that also frames certain social preferences of the time in the audiences, according to the buyers, etc. They serve also for social distinction. So that's, I'm interested to see that in the case of Chile, but also understand that in a more general process. So that's my main interest. Thank you.
So I'm José Emilio Pérez Martínez. I'm a radio historian from Spain, but actually working at Sorbonne Université in Paris. And I came here to this transnational radio history summer school to try to learn a little bit more about that that transnational perspective, because I've been researching mainly about women and radio in Spain during the dictatorship and about the free radio movement. So I came here to talk a little bit about that transnational perspective of the free radio movement. But surprisingly, I have to recognize that after 4 days of non-stop talking about radio, I'm coming back home with a new interest in life, which is related with the idea of archives and how to archive all this radio history related material that is gonna get lost anyway. So I think that has been an enriching experience that actually has made me think a lot, and I would try to do something, no, to save this all this material that is gonna get lost anyway. So it's our responsibility. So thank you very much.
I'm Brian Green and I'm from Dublin, Ireland. I'm at the summer school in transnational radio history because of my lifelong interest in radio and now radio history. The week has been quite amazing, some great talks. In one morning there was 7 talks. There's 2 tours where we visited RTL studios and the Radio Luxembourg transmitter site, and then a whole day of a transmitter visit to the Europe 1 transmitter site in Saarland in Germany. And throughout the week, the overall take home that I would have from the summer school is that research is alive and active in radio history, and it is ongoing, and there's networks forming for the enhancement of this history recording, and that when we go back to our respective countries, that we, you know, do more for the preservation of radio history within our own countries.
A podcast from the Transnational Radio History Summer School in Luxembourg, and I'm glad to have provided them with the wireless signature tune. One of the keynote speakers at the summer school was Dr. Christine Skog of Bournemouth University, who has done research about the history of women's radio broadcasting in the UK, including the iconic BBC Radio 4 programme Women's Hour. I spoke to Christine and asked her to tell me about her work on radio history.
Yes, so I started my PhD research very much focused on the BBC's women's programmes from sort of 46 into the mid-50s. So I looked at programmes like Women's Hour, which we can still hear on Radio 4 today. I also looked at a very famous, at least then it was very well known, radio serial, kind of a domestic soap opera called Mrs. Dale's Diary, which have more or less become a bit forgotten, I would say, particularly by the scholarship. So there's not that much research on it. So I explored the kind of development of these programmes and also, you know, the people behind them. Often they were made by women, you know, they were for, the housewives, but also particularly within Women's Hour, there were some really interesting debates in the late 40s, early 50s. How can we actually also address the working woman, the professional woman? Because they received a lot of letters from professional women saying, we also listen to the program. Can you, for example, introduce a repeat so we can listen on the weekend when we are free?
And can you tell us then about the research group in which you're involved called Entangled Media Histories? What does Entangled Media Histories mean?
Yes, so I'm part of a network called Entangled Media Histories, or MHIS, that was formed in 2013. It was a collaboration between Bournemouth University, Hamburg University and Lund University in Sweden. And the network has really focused on exploring media history using the concept of entanglement. And the way we have interpreted this is to move away from kind of monomedia histories. If you're looking at radio, for example, you know, you have to look at, say, you know, how you know, the press was used, or, you know, this interesting relationship to film, for instance. Radio didn't just exist in a sort of a vacuum of its own. So it's kind of looking at those intermedial, transmedial relationships, but it's also aiming to kind of shift our focus away from, the national, to kind of, again, take into account transnational ideas and flows. So I suppose making it much more of an integrated or integrated histories, I suppose you could call it.
And why histories rather than history? Different versions of the past? Is that what you mean by that?
I suppose that there are several histories that are connected. I mean, if I think about my own work on women and radio, and again using this idea of entanglement, for example, you know, it's these programs were often entangled with, say, the women's movement. They don't sort of exist in isolation. They were often also, the women broadcasters, the editors, for example, of Women's Hour, were often interviewed, talked about in the women's press, in the women's magazines of the same period, and they were sort of talking about women's radio, women's magazines as being a kind of a club for women. So there are kind of several histories that we need to explore, and I think again entanglement helps us to kind of, you know, look at how these all kind of fit together. To look at one side, you have to look at another. It's if that makes sense. It's yeah. those kind of crossings.
And why the why is the transnational aspect so important then? Obviously, radio was very much developed in a very rigid national framework based on national broadcasters, public broadcasters, and then followed by commercial broadcasters at a later stage. So why does the transnational matter?
Well, I would argue, I mean, was it actually formed within that national framework? I think there were a lot of exchanges, a lot of influences through people, for example, you know, moving across different sort of countries, sharing experiences. So in some ways, I think there's always been some kind of, you know, influence from abroad, even with the early days of the BBC, kind of looking ahead, looking across America, I suppose, and sort of we don't want that kind of chaos in the ether. So I think, you know, there's always been an aspect, I think, of influence from outside or you know, listening out. Or so I think it's really important.
Is there a danger with the entangled approach, however, that it becomes very difficult to manage from a researcher's point of view in terms of methodology? If you're entangled, you're potentially mixed up, tied up with an awful lot of other issues. So where do you draw the line as a researcher if you take, on a very practical level, if you take an entangled media histories approach, what do you do to stop yourself from getting caught up in far too much detail?
I think that's definitely a good point to make. And I think with any methodological approach, there's always challenges. And I think, I mean, I don't have an answer to that now because it's something that we, you know, we are kind of working on. But I think that is potentially a challenge with it, that you end up looking at too many things. So what is the focus here? What is it that you are, you know, you are studying? What is it that you're trying to say? But I think on the other hand, if we don't look at, you know, these kind of intercrossings, these interrelationships, these connections, I think we also risk of having, you know, writing a history that is then very isolated and that doesn't really acknowledge, you know, the sort of all these other contexts that are so important. So I think it is a challenge, but you know, hopefully there will be ways to to work around it.
I presume that the transnational approach is very much a response to the discipline of radio studies in general, having been perhaps too national in its approach in the past. Is that correct?
I think so, but I think that's probably, it's not just radio studies. I think a lot of media studies, media history, has tended to be very kind of, as I said, kind of focused on its national histories. It's very kind of mono media histories. So we have, I think, in, you know, in Britain, there's been a tradition to write the history of the BBC, you know, the history of the press, the history of film, or, you know, cinemas, and actually not really making those connections. And so I think it's a move away from that. And but I think it's something that is across, you know, media history and history in general. So it's, you know, I suppose broader disciplinary influences into radio history as well.
And of course, speaking of connections, then, you spoke this morning about your favourite source, which is related to radio but in a different medium, a journal, a radio journal. Can you tell us about that and why that is so interesting to you?
Yes, so this is my new favourite source, I call it. It's a radio fan magazine from the 1930s called Radio Pictorial. That was a weekly magazine that was published. So we have here, you know, print media, a magazine, but it's all about radio, and it's very much focused on sort of celebrity culture. So if you compare Radio Pictorial to, say, a magazine like Radio Times, it's very different in the way that it actually focused on the announcers, on the BBC stars, or the, you know, the continental personalities, you know, from the personalities from continental sort of radio stations, putting those kind of you know, giving those personalities a face, you know, something that people could, you know, that would recognize them. Or
and was this unprecedented at the time? Was this a real breakthrough to introduce that celebrity element?
I think, I mean, it's a new area for me. So I think in terms of Britain, I don't know yet of any other magazines that had this. I mean, I think in the Radio Times, you would sometimes, of course, get glimpses behind the scenes, or again, photographs of kind of broadcasting practices and so forth. But I think Radio Pictorial, you know, it did provide a different side to it. And as far as I know, I think it was fairly unique. But of course, there are other examples outside of Britain. So that's what has been so great about this morning session, because I've heard from several colleagues, you know, we had similar magazines in Germany, for example. So I think that's definitely something I want to explore further. And
you said that this was almost like the beginning of the development of a celebrity culture around media, that we can see the seeds of this type of development, and that you've discussed this with your own students as a precursor to the modern celebrity age and social media and so on.
Yeah, I mean, what I've done with my students is we've sort of looked at, you know, the concept of celebrity, you know, and the construction of celebrity. And we might think of it as a very modern phenomenon, but actually it goes back, it has such a long history, you know, even further back. But some people would argue that with the emergence of mass media, so, you know, press, cinema, radio, it sort of intensified. And of course, it becomes very much commercialized as well, you know, with kind of product placements and having certain stars attached to certain products. And so we looked a lot at Hollywood fan magazines, which of course began much earlier. But I think in the 30s, you start to see a sort of a celebrity culture also growing within the medium of radio. So we get in America, for example, of course, radio programs focusing on films. So, you know, because obviously film was still very big, you know, going to cinema. So the medium, the radio medium is kind of capitalizing on that. And at the same time, for film, radio was a new medium to use for promotion. So there's quite an interesting relationship between the two. And I think there's probably similar histories to be explored in say the British context. So that's what I'm interested in. And we also get, I suppose, a form of commercialization. So something I brought with me was also an album or a little booklet that was distributed or sold for a penny by Will's Cigarettes. So you could, you know, when you bought a cigarette pack, you would get some photographs, some little cards with the, you know, various announcers or band leaders or, you know, people from the BBC that you could then stick into your album, and you could collect these. And obviously you wanted to have the whole album filled. So this kind of material culture, you know, that I think it's really interesting to kind of explore, and that's what I'm hoping to do. So
Dr. Christine Skoge of Bournemouth University telling us about her research on women in British radio history. And we'll be featuring more interviews with participants at the Summer School on Transnational Radio History in the next series of Wireless, starting in September.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The Broadcasting Authority of Ireland has announced details of its second archiving scheme, which aims to contribute to the safeguarding of Irish heritage by encouraging the development of an archiving culture in the Irish broadcasting sector. This is the second round of the archiving scheme to be launched by the BAI, and it will run until the end of 2022. Under the original scheme, more than €5 million in funding was awarded to 14 successful applicants. Successful projects included the provision of funding to Tg Cathair to digitise Irish language news and current affairs, for RTE to archive television news film from 1961 to 1969, and for the IFI to restore a collection of 200 Irish TV adverts from the 1960s to the 1980s. But where does radio feature in the scheme, and how can it benefit from it? I spoke to BAI manager Elizabeth Farrelly about what is involved.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, it's the second archiving scheme that we just announced the other day will be in operation for the next couple of years until 2022. The first archiving scheme was in operation from 2012 to April 2016. And under the first scheme, we were obligated to administer a scheme under the Broadcasting Act 2009. And the scheme's objectives really were to help safeguard the preservation of our broadcasting heritage. Because as you're aware, there might be very valuable material in terms of cultural and historical program material that broadcasters have that would be at risk of being disappearing because it would be on an older format or that would soon be obsolete. So the purpose of the scheme really is to preserve that material and to safeguard our heritage for future generations, and also more generally to promote archiving activities within the wider broadcasting sector.
And did it become apparent to the BAI that there was a problem, that valuable material was potentially being lost?
Well, I suppose on a general basis, from discussions with broadcasters and individuals, we were aware that there would be a lot of material that broadcasters simply didn't have the capacity to protect. But also, I suppose the requirement to develop that culture of broadcasting within the sector, the culture of archiving, excuse me, within the broadcasting sector, was considered to be something that would be beneficial to the country as a whole.
So can you give us a flavour then of some of the achievements of the first round of the archiving scheme a number of years ago?
So as I mentioned, the first archiving scheme ran until April 2016. Under the scheme, over 5.1 million euro was awarded to a range of projects. I think 14 applicants and 23 projects, excuse me. And the applicants came from a range of sectors, public, commercial and community broadcasters, as well as cultural or representative organizations. So, for example, we would have awarded funding for archiving projects with RTE and TG Cahir, but likewise we would have awarded funding for archiving projects with community radio stations such as Connemara Community Radio and Near FM in Dublin. And then another archiving project was provided funding for the Irish Film Archive, and that was in relation to advertisements from the 60s, 70s and 80s, which gave us a glimpse, I suppose you could say, of Ireland of a different time. And it's available on the IFI player, and it's quite entertaining to take a look at some of those old adverts.
And indeed, we've featured the archives of Near FM and Connemara Community Radio on this programme before. So can you talk about the significance of those projects as they relate to community media?
Well, community media would have it's a very valuable resource in terms of providing a flavour of different sections of Ireland. And as you can expect, what Connemara Community Radio has in its archives might be very different from what Dublin, from what Near FM has in its archives, given the fact that one is from Dublin City and one is from Connemara. In relation to providing community radio stations an opportunity to preserve the material they have, it's important to note that we were aware that some community stations mightn't necessarily have the capacity to archive all their material, and also the archiving expertise in-house. And for that reason, we would always encourage any applicants, including community radio stations, to seek that potential archiving expertise by partnering with other bodies or gaining external archiving advice. And for example, with Connemara Community Radio, I believe they've had help from RTE in relation to their project.
And what are the themes then that are covered by this scheme? Because obviously, you know, certain radio stations can broadcast an awful lot of music, maybe contemporary music, chart music, may not necessarily be worth archiving those type of programmes, but other programmes would have more historical importance perhaps.
Well, it's a very wide scope in terms of what's available or what's eligible to be applied for under the scheme. So people can apply to have funding given for relevant program material that they have. And relevant program material really relates to material that was made for broadcast or broadcast in whole or in part. Or in addition to that, material that was, for example, photographic stills that would have been taken in the context of a broadcast recording. As you mentioned, some material would be considered maybe more culturally or relevant than others, but that is somewhat subjective. So, for example, while somebody might consider the value of a news and current affairs program to be very important. Likewise, it should be noted that there's also cultural value in other programs that might not necessarily be about news and current affairs, but are providing an insight into the social aspects of Ireland from a particular time. So there's a wide scope in terms of eligibility. And as long as you have relevant program material that was made for broadcast, you can apply for funding under the scheme.
So you essentially leave it up to the station or to the broadcaster to decide what they want to prioritise themselves?
Absolutely, we do. And they need to demonstrate in their application the value of that material. And also, if the material is significantly at risk, some material, by the very nature that it's older and was therefore saved on an older format than maybe more recent material, might be of risk of being lost in comparison to other material. And that is a factor to consider as well, because we undertook a review of the first archiving scheme. And while that very much demonstrated that stakeholders such as broadcasters, individuals and representative organisations were in support of the scheme and wanted it to be continued, what was highlighted was the need for preservation vis-a-vis storage, and the fact that there was a race against time for certain material that was at risk of being lost. So under the current scheme that is hoping to be kickstarted in July with a round for funding, we're going to hopefully highlight the importance of preservation and the fact that somebody can seek to make material, to apply for archiving funding to preserve material that is significantly at risk.
And in relation to the scheme that's about to be announced in the near future, can you give us some information about how that will work?
Well, the scheme operates on a round basis, so it's a competitive scheme process. We would open a round, hopefully we're opening a round at the end of July. Applicants will be given a minimum of 6 weeks to put an application together and apply to the scheme. There will obviously be an application form and guidelines available on our website, and people are always open to giving us a call simply if they have any questions around the application process. In terms of assessment, there is an assessment judging panel that will also take into account, have members on the panel that have archiving expertise from the broadcasting sector. And once decisions are reached, we would hope to have an announcement by the end of the year as to what applicants were awarded funding.
And obviously, if we consider RTE, I mean, RTE has a very extensive archives department of its own and an excellent website for radio and television, but there, I suppose there could be some sort of an imbalance there between RTE and other stations. So is there any sense that this is an attempt to address that imbalance, or is this equally applicable to everybody in the broadcasting sector?
Well, it is equally applicable to everybody in the broadcasting sector. So public service broadcasters such as RTE can apply to the scheme, and likewise commercial broadcasters can apply to the scheme, as well as community broadcasters. And it should be noted that it's not just broadcasters that can apply to the scheme. There might be an individual out there that has very relevant material and they're not quite sure how to go about archiving it. And in that sense, they can hopefully, if they don't have the capacity to do so themselves, they can partner with a relevant body to try and preserve that material. In terms of assessment and strategic assessment, under the previous scheme, there was a range of applicants and also a range of those that were awarded funding, and we would always be cognizant of the fact that certain applicants don't have the capacity in comparison to other applicants to be awarded funding, and based on the amount of funding available, that would be spread across various different sectors.
Elizabeth Farrelly, manager at the BAI, telling us about their new archiving scheme for audiovisual heritage.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Although there are only three full-time student radio stations on FM in the Republic, ourselves, Wired FM in Limerick and UCC 98.3 FM in Cork, many third-level institutions have some form of radio station, either part-time, temporary or online only.
The North's only student station is Queen's Radio, based at Queen's University Belfast, which has been on air since 2003. Flirt FM manager Paula Healy caught up with them recently.
So this afternoon I'm talking to Scott Duffield, who is the new station manager for next year of Queen's Radio in Belfast. Thank you so much for having a chat.
No worries, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
So you've just gotten nominated or elected to the new committee for the next year. You're station manager, but there's other different positions on the Queen's Radio committee. Can you tell me a bit more about how it works?
Yes, so we're quite a big team, as well as focusing on air, as you'd expect with the radio. We've got quite an extensive off-air team as well. And it's a great thing because we're all able to work on our own things, but together, come together and create quite a good radio station. So there's myself as station manager with my deputies, Jessica and Jane, and honestly, they hold the fort and make my life so much easier. And we've got a variety of teams from music, presenting news, our sound team, obviously, and then on off-air, we've got events, online content and entertainment.
That sounds absolutely amazing. It is a big team, but hopefully it's going to make the next year really, really smooth running for you. So have you been involved in Queen's Radio before this year, before you became station manager, or are you just getting dropped into it now?
So I have just finished my first year at Queen's University Belfast, and I joined Queen's Radio in October 2017 and went into the position of Deputy Online Content and Promotion. And that was a really good role. I didn't have a huge amount of responsibility because I had a head that I was just helping out, but it gave me a good insight into the society and the running of the station. And now I thought, you know what, I do have ambitions to take Queen's Radio into another great year, so why not go for station manager?
And speaking of another great year, you've just had a committee meeting over there. Have you got any plans that you can tell us about or any ambitions that you're working on?
There's always, as I'm sure you'd expect, a lot happening in the background. So if you do want to know about that, make sure to follow us on social media. But our biggest things this year are we're moving to a new station here at Queen's University Belfast Students' Union. We're actually moving into a temporary location while we get a better, bigger Students' Union. So we're moving into a new studio at the start of August. So that will be quite exciting. We're growing our news teams, our music teams. We're getting more content on the blogs as well as on air. And we're hoping to do more with other student radio stations across the rest of the Republic of Ireland.
Excellent. Well, we'll be involved in that if we can help out at all, definitely.
I'd be delighted for that.
Oh, no, it's like that's the biggest thing about student radio. It's all about solidarity and, socialising as well. We can learn from each other. Let's put it that way.
Definitely.
So when I was up in Queen's University before, the station was kind of up a couple of stories and it was a lovely station and everything, but it was a bit removed and out of the way, a bit like ours is here as well. Do you know much about the location or about the setup for the new Students' Union building that you're going to be going into?
The temporary residence that we'll be in, we're not too sure about where we'll be. We don't really know the size of the room, in fact, but we know that we will be in the main Students' Union hub where all the clubs and societies will be, so hopefully we'll be a bit more visible to the public eye. But then in the final new building that they're going to start building at this time next year, I think we're going to be in a much more visible place. So that will be 4 years off, I think.
Okay. But Queen's Radio has been around for a while at this stage. So I think you're in it for the long haul anyway. So another 4 years is like it's worth doing for the future of the station, I think.
It really is. We became an official station back in 2003. And since then, we've just been going from strength to strength.
Oh, happy 15th birthday, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. I should have known that. thank you very much. So we broadcast 24/7, so it is something that people can tune in to any time, and I think that's something that's worked really well for us and why we have done really well over the last 15 years.
So a bit of nitty gritty about, like, tell us a bit more about the station. Do you guys have a music policy, or do you just do volunteers just get to play whatever they want to play?
We do have a music policy, and we let local artists approach us, and they can email our head of music. All that contact information is over on the website if there are any musicians listening. and we make sure that we get the rights to all the music, and we have to meet a quota of how much music we play from each artist each week.
Oh, very good. And do you have any kind of a chart system or anything like that? Because it's quite complicated to do things.
We don't have a chart show or anything like that yet. That's something that we're looking to introduce in September whenever on campus. And we're in the process of renewing our software so that we can get a better way of weighting the music so that it gets played. But we do make sure that everything's played exactly how it needs to be, matching the criteria set out by the producers.
Okay, it sounds a bit like us with our percentages that we have to adhere to down here as well. So just because you're not on like FM full license doesn't mean that you don't have things to worry about.
Yeah, we're on the exact same regulations as you, I presume. And going FM is something that we'd like to do in the future, but we're not sure how far off that ambition is.
It does bring with it some responsibilities that sometimes keep me awake at nights, though. So, like, thinking of positive things, though, apart from, like, trying to get everybody to make sure that they're doing everything as they should be, you had an award winner as a part of the Smedias this year. It was one of your DJs won a national award. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
That was actually last year, so that was before I joined Queen's Radio, but that was a huge step for us and amazing for our presenters to get that on a national scale. This year we were delighted that our, flagship news programme, The Scoop, they were nominated for, I think it was Best Current Affairs and News. So they deal with all the on-campus news as well as wider political news, which I'm sure, as you can guess, in Northern Ireland, there's quite a lot of that.
There is a bit, yeah, especially this year.
Yes. So that's something that they've done through online, on the blog, on social media, as well as their weekly show. So they've done really, really well. So we're hoping that next year we'll continue our success in the media.
And are you guys involved in the Student Radio Association in the UK, or do you ever go to any of their events as well?
We aren't involved with much in the UK, mainly because it's more difficult for people to get out here. I'm actually phoning you from Scotland because that's where I'm from.
Okay, I was wondering, so, I was going to ask about the accent, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that next year we're able to start creating more ties with the rest of the UK, because I'd say that our relationships with the stations down in the Republic of Ireland are actually quite strong, and they're hoping that we're able to expand on them as well as find new relationships across Scotland, England and Wales.
We would actually love to head over to some SRA events ourselves, but I think we're in exactly the same boat as you. It's a bit more difficult to get across because you can't just get a bus.
Yeah, a bit more expensive, and it's finding the time as well for a good group of us to go across and do events. So it's something that we hope to do, though.
So the last question, I suppose, is, I know you'll be planning over the summer, but when do you guys, when does everything kind of kick off for you?
So next semester starts in the end of September, so we'll be writing at it at the Freshers' Fair. So I think that's the week beginning the 16th of September. Around then is when all the first years will be coming back to university. So we're hoping to start right off from the front there. And yes, throughout the summer, we're still broadcasting live every day, 24/7. So you can tune in online to our stream and across our blogs as well. We'll have content going up right throughout. So it's almost as if we never stopped.
You're gluttons for punishment. We don't stop either, so it's exhausting. But anyway, Scott, like you said, I would absolutely love to join up and do more things with you and meet loads of other student radio stations around the country this year. So hopefully that'll all come to fruition. And thanks so much for having a chat with us.
No worries. Thank you for having me on.
Scott Duffield of Queen's Radio in Belfast talking to Paula Healy.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
On June 22nd, National Community Radio Day was held all around the country, with various stations participating in and relaying a live broadcast from Athlone Community Radio. A national campaign to increase participation in community broadcasting was launched on the day. The campaign, entitled Community Speak, is being organised by the Community Radio Forum of Ireland, CRAIL. It was launched during a two-hour live programme about the role of community radio in Ireland, broadcast from the Radisson Blue Hotel, Athlone. Here's a flavour of that broadcast, starting with Declan Gibbons, chair of CRAIL.
Focusing on what they're saying, so it's literally it's you talking to me and me talking to you, and so therefore, you know, you're able to relax and just discuss what we're talking about.
But also, when you mention that, it's for the person who has that slight interest. You can go and you can learn, and it is a learning environment.
It's big time a learning environment, because there's so much. There's technical stuff. There's a lot of research. There's obviously, radio is highly regulated, and you know it needs to be regulated because it is actually a great power and it's a privilege and opportunity to broadcast. It really is. Mm. But there is all of that, and there's the legal side of it as well. So there is a great deal of learning, and I think most people who get involved, you might come in to answer phones or just because you just wondered, and people get kind of hooked on it, and they just as you say, they learn because there's so much involved. And if you can learn and add to your own skills and also indulge your passion as well, well then it's win-win everywhere, isn't it?
Absolutely. CRAIL, you do so much. There's so many other bodies involved, including government bodies as well.
Well, like CRAIL is just it's the volunteers, it's the stations. I mean, all of the full-time stations are full members. The developing stations are, there's various forms of other forms of classes of membership, but we're all in this thing together, and it's all about a volunteer. I'm the manager of a station of Community Radio Kilkenny City, but in our CRAIL roles we're all volunteering, because it does take a lot of our time to go to meetings and, you know, and try and plan events like this one today. So CRAIL is, it's the stations and it's the volunteers involved. It's not some big monolithic creature, if you like. And then obviously we've got Martine O'Brien, who's the development coordinator, and it's about development, support, and about training. I think those are the roles that CRAIL provides to the stations. Mm-hmm. And like, we're all learning from one another, and thankfully we're not in competition with one another. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge strength.
Absolutely. When we talk about learning and learning environment, CRAIL expands out beyond just Ireland with that learning environment. Many people have had the opportunity in the past to travel to Europe and be involved in European schemes.
Yes, and they can be, they're, I suppose, gives a sense, what CRAIL is trying to do today is say that, you know, create awareness of the national network of stations, but obviously we're part of a greater thing, and AMARC is the European community radio overall governing body, and an Irish woman was president of it recently, and that's Sally Galliana of Near FM. But yeah, it's brilliant, because community radio is highly developed in a lot of different countries, and indeed there's various funding models, and some countries take it really, really seriously and feel that it's worth funding, and we're trying to progress that agenda here as well. But yeah, I agree. There's an awful lot to be learned, and there's a lot of projects there involving other countries, and we're all learning from those. And I might mention, Catherine, that we got news just this week that in Romania two new stations have been licensed in rural villages in Romania, and it's seen as a big win for the community radio movement across Europe. So
absolutely,
it's exciting.
That's amazing. We're just going to finish up now, but every week across Ireland 2,000 community radio volunteers engage with an estimated 170,000 listeners. Where to next?
Oh, well, more of those, because
more.
Because those figures are even, you know, I'd say we're up over probably the 200,000 listener mark at this stage. And the theme of this week, Catherine, is of National Community Radio Day this year, is Community Speak. It's volunteer with your community station. So we're trying to get more people involved to volunteer with their station, realise that opportunity is there, get involved, and we really hope that this will generate a little bit of interest. So I'm hoping that those volunteers, instead of being 170,000, they'll be 200,000. The volunteers, instead of being 2,000, they'll be 3,000. And the listeners might be 250,000 very soon.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on this special day, and for launching this day for us here by the banks of the glorious Shannon.
Delighted, Catherine. And of course, it's, you know, you're not just broadcasting to Athlone, because there's stations all over the country, including our own, listening in today.
Yeah, and a big shout out to all of the listeners in Kilkenny. Now we are going to have a chat with a very special lady to us in Athlone. We're going to talk to the chairperson of Athlone Community Radio, Claire Hall.
Hiya.
Thanks very much for coming down today.
No problem.
Big old day. Big old day for everyone at the station. So you're involved with community radio. How did it start?
Well, Catherine, to be honest, it started because I was a big nerd that wanted to talk about history and nobody wanted to listen to me. So I said, I'm taking this to the airwaves and I'm going to make people listen to me.
Yeah.
And community radio lets me talk about whatever I want to talk about.
Which is?
History. All the history.
Yes, yes. So do you know when the castle was built?
I think it was about 1210.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. What time is it now? Is it 1210? Yeah, that's how I try to remember. It's not 1210 yet, but it's 1210 when the castle was built. Yeah, your love of history, it really comes alive with community radio, though.
Yeah, definitely, because people will listen to me.
but you have the depth and you have the knowledge to be able to give people very interesting information.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like to think I do anyway.
Well, our listeners think you do. Now, moving on to your role as the chairperson of the radio station. How did that come about? Because it's for our listeners, it's a volunteer role.
It is, well. Yeah. Well, I've been on the board for a couple of years anyway. And we were just having a change-up and needed a new chair. And I thought, I might as well go for it. It'll be a challenge, but it's nice to kind of take the bull by the horns and give it a go. And community radio is so important that I really want to be heavily involved anyway.
Yeah, but with the changes of governance now, and although the volunteer sector, it's part of the body for directors to have more knowledge about what they're doing, even in the volunteer sector.
Yes, and that's probably the biggest challenge, because that's not something that I would have had much of a focus on in my day job. So it's been really interesting, actually, to learn a lot more. And CRAIL is great for that, because they're running a lot of training programs and we're getting heavily involved in coming up to the standard. And it's great to see the community radios getting so behind it.
Absolutely. And as a person who is involved with history and so forth, you were involved with other programs as well, the women's program. So you got to expand out your interests.
Yeah, and my knowledge base a bit, because with Coffee Morning, which Alona Rock does at the minute, I was involved in that at the beginning, and it was great. You're talking about all types of topics and you're interviewing all types of people, and there's so many voices on a program like that, so it was absolutely fascinating.
And we're delighted to have on the table by the Shannon. No teas or coffees in front of them, though, I don't know. From Ross FM, Bernie Kenny, it's a pleasure to have you here. And Tommy McCabe from Tullamore Community Radio Station. It's super to have you sitting here. I know you're just, did you get the boat down the river or did you drive?
No, I drove, no, but it's a nice setting. Certainly you could get the boat down the river and keep going for a bit, yeah.
You could.
It's a lovely setting for this morning, yeah.
So with Ross FM, how long have you been in existence for?
Well, Ross FM started in about 2004, and Ross FM actually started from a project that was in Roscommon Leader Partnership at the time. It was a project called Ross Equal. So it was about giving everyone a chance and bringing people, getting everyone up to a certain level, and a special emphasis on people with disabilities, in a way to allow them to show their abilities rather than the disabilities. So that's what the background Ross FM came from. I would always be involved myself over the years as a volunteer, I suppose, for about 45 years now. So they were setting up a kind of a committee for Ross FM, and that's how I landed on board now. I wouldn't be a great radio person myself on the air or anything like that now. But
I don't know. It's a lovely voice.
I don't think now. You know, I do a little bit now, but. But I've been involved with the station since ever since the start. Yeah.
And do you have any particular area that you love, or you love it all, or you know what's your favourite part of of volunteering?
Well, I suppose I love, I like the whole thing of volunteering, you know. The difference volunteers has made to everything in Ireland. You know, if we had to replace volunteers in Ireland, we'd have a lot of gaps. I suppose that's the one of the biggest things, you know. And our station is totally dependent on volunteers. Mm. We're on there 40 hours a week, but we don't have any paid staff. So the role of volunteers, I find, very important. And again, I suppose, linking up with the community and the different things there.
And Claire, just going back, we're going to be talking to Tommy in a minute about the startup of a new station. How important are our volunteers to the success of the station, Claire?
Oh, we couldn't do it. Yeah, we couldn't do it without them. It's absolutely vital to have volunteers who are willing to come in and give us all their information and work behind the scenes and do everything. Absolutely. Couldn't run a station without volunteers.
And we move over to Tommy then, who's in the pros. Tommy McKay from Tullamore, and a big shout out to everybody in Tullamore. Not too far down the road, 40K, is it?
20 minutes, 25 minute drive.
25 minute drive down the road. An aspirin station.
Exactly, yeah.
So for our listeners, what does that mean? What stage are you at?
In February 2017, a group of us got together and said, look, we'd love to start a community radio station in Tullamore. We went ahead. We had our first public meeting April of last year. We had a good show at that, and we went out and about, and we made it known that we're starting a community radio station. We were looking for volunteers.
Yeah.
And we're at the stage now where we have we're streaming online. The audio from the radio station, and we're doing as live programming from remote locations. So basically we have a central hub which runs the radio station. It's software driven, and then we have presenters who come in and record programs from remote locations from around the town.
Wow, okay, so they're recording remotely from different spots around the town. Claire,
yeah.
Claire.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And this is the great thing about having these conversations is that we get to hear how other stations run and function, and that's a fantastic concept. I see Claire's eyes going.
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah.
Well, if we were offered rent-free studios. The old Midlands 103 studios have been very supportive to us as well, so big hello to the guys there. And we decided, look, it's great to be offered this, but the minute you open that door, you've got rent, you've got rates, you've got broadband, you've got electric, you've got all these associated costs, but you've no revenue.
Yeah.
So that's why we decided, listen, we'll have a remote location where the radio is streamed from, and all our presenters simply open up the laptop, plug in the USB mic, log in via the username and password. There goes the playlist in front of them, and they present a show.
Well, there was silence there because I was speechless.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we'll do a demo.
Wow. So, Bernie, since you've been involved since 2004, technology has moved on a bit from putting in the CDs to playing off a computer.
It didn't move on that much for myself, you know. but certainly technology, you know, you can nearly do anything with technology nowadays, you know. But I suppose there's still a certain amount of expertise, even though, you know, I suppose there's an old saying, whether you're a volunteer or not nowadays, you still have to do it fairly professionally. So, you know, as you said, technology has moved on there, but there's a certain amount of expertise in doing anything. You know, I suppose, you know, we all had novelties in our life growing up. It could be driving the car or driving the tractor or driving a machine or playing a guitar or something like that. And some people might have that about radio as well, you know. But it's just maybe just doesn't suit everyone either. But I think it's a lovely concept to let people. I was talking to one of the presenters on one of the local radios, and he was saying, you know, community radio is where you can learn, where you can make the odd mistake, and no one's, it doesn't matter. But, you know, it prepares you for doing the other things. So.
An excerpt from the live broadcast on Athlone Community Radio to celebrate Community Radio Day 2018. And you can listen back to Flirt FM's special broadcast featuring community radio material from Wireless on our blog wirelessflirt.wordpress.com. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3 and indeed to this series of the programme. We're off on our holidays now, but we'll be back in September with more radio news, including more material from the Summer School on Transnational Radio History in Luxembourg. I hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. Until the next edition of Wireless in September, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.